This was not straightforward, as Acts itself testifies, chapter 5, verses 1 through 11. But the principle extended into the wider church, not least in the command to love. We see this, for instance, in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 9 through 12, where the command to love means, make sure you earn what you can and give what you can to those in need, and in particular in Paul's pet project, the substantial collection of money from the Gentile churches around the Aegean coastline to support the church in Judea following the famine, Acts chapter 11, verses 27 through 30, 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verses 1 through 4, 2 Corinthians chapters 8 and 9, Romans chapter 15, verses 25 through 29. How exactly does this play into the idea of the Christians being rulers in God's new world? Paul answers that question by gathering it all together in Ephesians chapter 3 and declaring that this mission of generating and sustaining Jew plus Gentile churches on Gentile soil, binding together in love a surprised new family that was discovering a different way to be human, was a direct sign to the powers of the world that God was God, that Jesus was Lord, and that the time had come for the world's present rulers to be confronted with their rightful master. After all, Alexander the Great had seen himself as the true world ruler because he had brought together Greeks and barbarians into a single empire. The various Roman emperors, following Augustus, the first and possibly the greatest to bear that title, saw themselves as the true rulers of the world because they united in their empire people of many different nations. Paul saw the achievement of Jesus, drawing together the two archetypal divisions of humankind, Jew and Gentile, into one, as signaling not only that the new temple had thereby been built, but also that the new Lord had been announced. Being rulers meant, for the early Christians, living together in the way that declared to the world that Jesus, the crucified and risen one, was the world's true sovereign. It is enormously important, both for our historical understanding and for our contemporary reflection, that we consider the way in which the early Christians thus understood themselves to be living, at the same time, both as model citizens of their various countries and as people owing allegiance to the new Lord. The virtue which they were to develop was not entirely discontinuous with the virtues of the pagan world around them. Indeed, Paul can appeal to the moral standards of surrounding paganism to show the Corinthians just how badly they are themselves behaving. Look, he says, even the pagans don't do that. 1 Corinthians chapter 5 verse 1. And he can assume that there are all kinds of standards in common. Hate what is evil, he says, and hold fast to what is good. Romans chapter 12 verse 9. The church is to behave wisely toward outsiders. Colossians chapter 4 verse 5. Seeking peace. Romans chapter 12 verses 14 through 21. Obeying the authorities, while remembering that they too answer to God. Something many pagan authorities prefer to forget. Romans chapter 13 verses 1 through 7. And holding their heads up within their own communities. Philippians chapter 1 verse 27. Indeed, it is in Philippians that we find Paul giving a strong nod of approval to the wider world of pagan virtue. For the rest, my dear family, these are the things you should think through. Whatever is true, whatever is holy, whatever is upright, whatever is pure, whatever is attractive, whatever has a good reputation, anything virtuous, anything praiseworthy. Philippians chapter 4 verse 8. This doesn't mean that Christians should go along with everything the world does. The next verse insists, as we saw in an earlier discussion, that Paul's own way of life, radically different from that of the world around, must be the model for that. He calls his readers to do what you learned, received, heard, and saw in and through me. However, there are many things out there in the wider world which, because of God's goodness in creation, really are true, holy, upright, pure, attractive, well-reputed, virtuous, and praiseworthy. Christians should not be mealy-mouthed about this. We should be the first to give praise where praise is due, and equally, to think through these things, to ponder them, to inquire how they work and the effect they have. What, then, are the particular Christian virtues of being rulers, kingdom people, practicing in the present time for the royal priesthood, which is promised us in the new world? The answer comes once more, unsurprisingly, in the character which Christians are to develop, the character of love, gentleness, meekness, and so on. These are the things which, according to Jesus in the Beatitudes, will characterize those who are to be set over God's world. These are the things which Jesus himself exemplified throughout his life and supremely in his giving of himself to death. These are the things which the early Christians busily set about practicing, not least in looking after the poor and sustaining communities of mutual support. This may not be everybody's idea of kingship, but it does begin to look as though the redefinition of royalty, which was put into effect throughout Jesus' life, and particularly in the great narrative sequence extending from his riding into Jerusalem on a donkey through to his death on a Roman cross, had taken hold of the imagination and life of his followers. If this is what it meant for him to be king, they would find and follow similar paths to take up their own royal responsibilities, to practice in the present the virtues of the royal priesthood. The fundamental habits of this new, strange, upside-down royalty are therefore becoming clear, and they are the very things which Jesus and Paul were urging. They are the virtues, hard initially, but second nature after long practice, which generate communities in whose life the lordship of Jesus is apparent, a life which by its very nature doesn't stay as hidden property within those communities, but of necessity spills out into the world around as people see human life lived in a radically different, an often compellingly attractive way. Here again, the life of Christian virtue is a team sport. It is in this context, too, that the church gains the platform and the moral right to speak publicly about Jesus and announce him as Lord, explaining how he died for the sins of the world and rose again. In other words, at the heart of the calling to be a royal priesthood lies the task of evangelism, proclaiming Jesus, persuading people to consider him, inviting people to give him their allegiance and discover through him, and through the company of his followers, a whole new way of being human, a life, in fact, of faith, hope, and love, of kindness and gentleness, of forgiveness and generosity, of patience and chastity. Evangelism, too, has something of the character of virtue. It must have seemed very strange for the early apostles to tell unsuspecting strangers that a crucified Jew was actually the Lord of the world. A strangeness which continues to be felt to this day in every culture, both those where the name of Jesus is well known and those where it isn't. But telling people the good news is habit-forming, and the habit is, like all Christian virtues, one that genuinely anticipates in the present time the life of the age to come, where celebration of Jesus' rescuing, healing lordship will be unstinted and unending. At that point, of course, the royal and priestly vocations join up once more. But the notion of reflecting God's image once more into the world, the image of the generous, loving Creator, filling his world with beauty, order, freedom, and glory, must go wider than community creation on the one hand and evangelism on the other. The royal vocation of Jesus' followers must give rise to the hard-won virtues of seeking, generating, and sustaining justice and beauty in a world where both have been at a discount for too long. This is a large topic, in need of much fuller exploration than we can give it here, but the line that runs forward from Aristotle's insistence on the beautiful and the just, at the start of his Nicomachean Ethics, is one which Christians should celebrate and advance. Consider justice. One of the greatest books in the New Testament, Romans, is about God's restorative justice. Those who are called to reflect God's image through their own work must give attention to the task of working out, in a highly contested contemporary world, what that restorative justice ought to look like and how we might help bring it about. This will mean engaging with political debates and processes of various sorts, campaigning on key issues, and highlighting oppression and injustice wherever they occur. The Western world has supposed, for 200 years and more, that splitting off questions of social justice from questions of God and faith would give us a more just society. The revolutions, totalitarianisms, and all-out wars of that period have proved us wrong. But to put God and human justice back together again will require a sustained effort, not only by individuals, but by the church as a whole, developing the corporate virtues of justice work that will become habits of the church's heart and will appeal to the conscience of the wider world. Similarly with beauty. If the temple in Jerusalem, the place where God's own glory was to dwell, was seen as the little world, the microcosm where the world's beauty was to be concentrated, then part of the virtue of the royal priesthood, the new and living temple, ought to be the cultivation and celebration of beauty at every level. This calls for the royal virtues of bringing that delicately balanced combination, order and freedom, to birth, as art has lurched from the over-ordered world of cubism to the multiply disordered and deliberately chaotic world of much recent pop art. How can we work in the present time to anticipate the future of God's remade world, where the horrors of today's world will at last be overcome? That is the challenge, as we seek to generate fresh expressions of beauty. Today's aesthetic world lurches to and fro between the brutalism that, starting with an architectural style, has spilled over into all manner of sheer tawdry ugliness, and the sentimentalism that, wishing still to glimpse the loveliness of creation, cannot find a way to express that without collapsing into kitsch. The virtues of the royal priesthood are called for to declare, in art as well as word, the hard-won victory of Jesus over the evil that has corrupted and defaced the world, and to declare the new creation, launched in the resurrection, of a world full of freedom and glory. Freedom itself must be generated, protected and celebrated. But thinkers from St. Paul in the middle of the first century to Bob Dylan in the middle of the 20th and beyond are still asking what freedom actually means. In a Christian sense, it clearly doesn't mean the random whizzing about of the subatomic particle, however much more eager political or psychological rhetoric may go on about the total removal of constraints. Removing constraints is what the governments did to the financial markets in the years before the recent economic crash. Not a good omen. For an actor to be free to play Hamlet, other actors must be involved, each of whom will curtail their own freedom in search of the higher freedom of being constrained by, but finding new meaning again and again within, Shakespeare's play. For musicians to be free to play the blues, the guitar must be in tune. The pianist must be practiced, if not perfect, serious, if not necessarily completely sober, and the drummer and bass player must discover their freedom within the quite severe constraints of a time signature. And for the ordinary citizen to be free politically, there must be forces of law and order that can hold back chaos and riot, defend property and life, and prevent the malicious and the violent from doing whatever they fancy. We willingly accept constraints like these. We recognize that a freedom, which consists merely of random or spontaneous activity, is not necessarily genuine freedom, but may be merely chaos. We seek a freedom which consists in a glad, integrated, thought-out choice of a life path, and which includes taking responsibility for working that path out, paying its way, and living with its consequences. And the Christian, called to reflect God's generous and creative love into the world, must develop the civic as well as personal virtues that will support and sustain this freedom, this giving to human beings the chance to be genuinely human. How that works out will be complex and demanding, with many odd twists and turns. Like all the great slogans, freedom raises a question rather than providing answers. But it is a Christian slogan as well, and those called to be royal priests must work at the virtues required to create conditions for it and enable it to flourish where and when it can. We are going to need this in the days to come. As world population increases, food sources and supply chains present new problems, and the world's climate changes alarmingly. We cannot assume that the whole world will steadily become more and more dominated by Western-style liberal democracy, with people meekly voting every once in a while and doing their own thing between elections. Freedom, like authenticity, is what we are promised when our desires and longings completely coincide with God's designs and plans for us as fully human beings. God's service, says the ancient prayer, is perfect freedom. And, as with authenticity, freedom grasped too soon becomes an over-realized eschatology, a failure to realize how much work virtue still has to do to bring it to the goal. But the point of virtue is to work at anticipating the future in the present, and glimpsing and grasping the true freedom we are offered in Jesus Christ is a vital element within that. Otherwise, the slogan of freedom becomes just an excuse for license, as Paul saw already in Galatians chapter 5. To accept appropriate moral constraints is not to curtail true freedom, but to create the conditions for it to flourish. Royal priests are, in short, to work at revealing the glory of God to the world. That is the task of the renewed temple. But if, as in John's Gospel, the glory of God is revealed when Jesus of Nazareth goes to the cross as the supreme act of love, John chapter 13 verse 1, chapter 17 verses 1 through 5, then we should expect that God's glory will be reflected out into the world when Jesus' followers learn the habits of mind, heart, and life that imitate the generous love of Jesus and thus bring new order, beauty, and freedom to the world. It is hugely important that we see these habits precisely as virtues, not simply as principles to be applied or values to be embraced. We do not start, as it were, with the Platonic form of justice, beauty, and freedom, so that, possessing that great and awesome knowledge, we might come down to earth with a grand plan for how these noble ideals should trickle down into reality from their Platonic ideal existence. We are given, rather, the promise that the earth shall be full of the knowledge and glory of God, as the waters cover the sea. We are given the resurrection of Jesus to be the start of that project. And we are given the Holy Spirit to enable us to anticipate the former by implementing the latter. To begin on those tasks does not mean we know it all and can see exactly what needs doing, as we might imagine if we thought of principles and values. It means that we are committed to taking the difficult first steps toward acquiring the corporate habits that will be justice-generating, beauty-producing, and freedom-enhancing, and to continue the many-sided debates as to what exactly those phrases will mean. And once again, every follower of Jesus will have his or her own unique and interestingly different vocation within this complex overall project. The task of being God's royal priesthood in the present, then, is all about worship and mission. A worship and mission which share a heart, the heart that is learning to love God the Creator and God the Recreator, and discovering how to develop the habits that will reflect God's love into the world and the world's grateful love back in return. We must now look further at how this might work out in practice. 3. I once had a student studying theology who spent his whole summer vacation working in a sub-Saharan African country. When he came back, the head of the college asked him what he wanted to do when he graduated. He replied that he was hoping to work in international development, bringing help and wisdom to the poorest parts of the globe. The head of the college at once asked him why, in that case, he was studying theology rather than politics and or economics. The student didn't miss a beat. "Because theology is much more relevant," he replied. He had seen, firsthand and over some months, the way in which the church had gone about its business in the country where he had lived. Liberation theology, as it was then known, wasn't any longer an abstract exercise, a seemingly exciting, flaky, and slightly dangerous sub-branch of systematic theology created to keep left-wing students from getting bored with the study of ancient dogmas. It was about churches, themselves poor and living among the poor, that were working out from day to day what it meant to call Jesus Lord and to make that lordship a living reality in their wider communities. I was proud of that student, both for his experience and for his answer. But as I reflected on the exchange, I wondered how we had got to the point in the Western world where it could be assumed that theology was irrelevant to the real needs of the real world. As I pondered this, I realized that though theology as a topic might seem remote, it isn't in fact, for those who control our news media have no idea what it is, so they routinely discount it, the practical life of the church reaches out into numerous areas of ordinary life in the Western world, unobtrusively, and without a blast on the trumpets. This fact needs highlighting and celebrating as an already flourishing reality. In England, the government's own statistics show that the solid majority of those who give their time, money, and energy to voluntary service in their communities, working with the elderly, the handicapped, the dying, the very young, and so on, are practicing Christians. Many of them will say that they're not very good Christians, meaning that they're aware of their own moral failures, of many things in the Bible they don't understand, and so on. But something in the lifeblood of the church has stirred them to offer help where help is needed, and they do it gladly, finding, not surprisingly, such a strong personal fulfillment in doing so that it keeps them coming back even when they themselves are getting old and tired. I know one couple who went on taking Meals on Wheels to elderly people around the town until they themselves, well into their 80s, were older than most of the people they were visiting. The habit of practical service, the outward and visible sign of the virtue of love, goes back to the early church. One of the most striking passages in Rodney Stark's remarkable book, The Rise of Christianity, is his description of how Christians in ancient Turkey would react when their town was struck by plague. The rich, the well-to-do, and particularly the doctors would gather up family and possessions and leave town. They would flee to the hills, to fresher and less polluted air, or to friends or family in town some distance away. But the Christians, often among the poorest, and many of them slaves, would stay and nurse people, including those who were neither Christians nor their own family members, nor in any other way obviously connected to them. Sometimes such people got well again. Not all diseases were necessarily fatal. Sometimes Christians would themselves catch the disease and die from it. But the point was made, graphically and unmistakably. This was a different way to be human. Nobody had ever thought of living like that before. Why were they doing it? And the Christians, called upon to explain the habits of the heart which made it natural, second nature, of course, to do such things, would talk about Jesus and about the God they had discovered through Jesus, the God whose own very nature was and is self-giving love. Stark suggests that this kind of behavior was one of many contributory reasons for the rapid spread of Christianity, despite the best efforts of efficient Roman persecutors, leading up to the time when, by the start of the 4th century, nearly half the empire was Christian, and the emperors decided it was better to join what seemed to be the winning side. All this ties in with Paul's exhortations in Romans chapter 12 and Philippians chapter 4, that Christians should practice the art of living as good citizens, celebrating what can be celebrated in the wider world, and grieving over what has brought sadness into people's lives. The generous Creator God is not honored, is not reflected into his world, by a church that stands aloof, secure in its own holiness, and looking down on the best that the rest of the world can do as so much unspiritual, unchristian, or ungodly rubbish. That doesn't mean there isn't a lot of rubbish out there, just as there is within the church itself. Precisely because the greatest Christian virtue is love, modeled on that of the creating and life-giving God, the individual Christian and the church as a whole must develop the settled habits of looking out for what's going on in the surrounding world, rejoicing with its joy, weeping with its grief, and above all, eager for opportunities to bring love, comfort, healing, and hope wherever possible. And with all these, it may bring faith, not necessarily by speaking of Jesus all the time, though there will be such opportunities, but by living Jesus in public. The world, and sadly some in the church too, may well sneer at the do-gooder. Sometimes the sneering may even be earned. Blundering self-righteousness is always possible, and must of course be avoided. But the abuse doesn't invalidate the use. It may well simply demonstrate that the work that needs doing is best done through habit, through virtue, through the ninefold fruit of the Spirit, through the conscious choices of a whole community and individuals within it in pursuit of their own particular vocation to develop, acquire, and sustain the habits of the royal priesthood. 4. If the Christian life of virtue as an outward look toward the wider world, what about the Christian theory of virtue? This question has been, in reality, one of the subtexts of this whole book. I trust that the rest of the exposition will stand up without the discussion to which we now turn. But since part of what I've been saying is that the habits of Christian virtue must be outward-looking, must reach out beyond the confines of the church, and must act in the world to bring healing and hope, it would be odd if we were then to retreat and declare that what the Christian says about Christian virtue has no point of contact with what the pagan says about pagan virtue, as though they were two quite separate things, neither overlapping nor impinging on one another. On the contrary, if the Christian claim is that in Jesus Christ and by the Spirit, the Creator God has launched a new way of being human, we should positively expect that there will indeed be an overlap, an interplay, perhaps a partial confrontation, possibly a partial convergence. This brings us, at two levels, into the huge area which theologians have loosely labeled nature and grace. One of the primary questions the study of that area raises is this. Is it possible for a human being, unaided by divine grace, that is, in the state of pure nature, to attain virtue? Paganism itself would have been divided over this question, since for some pagans, for Stoics at least, a divine power was at work in all human beings, so that all human life, not least all moral effort, would have been understood to have some kind of divine subcurrent flowing through it. But for Paul and the early Christians, thinking in a Jewish mode about creative and life-giving God, something much more explicit was called for. Yes, pagans could articulate and respect, and sometimes even live up to, noble ideals. But faith, hope and love, the full fruit of the Spirit, and the unity of the one body, these were further gifts, available only by the grace of Jesus Christ, going beyond what paganism could do. Without that grace, even the zealous follower of the Jewish law would end up in the same place as the puzzled pagan moralist. The good I want, I do not. The evil I do not want is what I do. Romans chapter 7 verse 19. But this is not the place to explain or justify this interpretation of that vexed passage. For grace to have the desired effect, Paul concluded, it isn't enough simply to add a bit onto nature. It isn't that nature, morally speaking, is good but incomplete and merely needs supplementing, topping up as it were. No, nature needs to be put to death and to come to life on the other side. Those who belong to the Messiah have crucified the flesh with its passions and desires. Galatians chapter 5 verse 24. As long as the cross remains a stumbling block to Jews and folly to pagans, so the work of grace in producing the moral life envisaged by the New Testament will be a matter not merely of supplement, but of crucifixion and resurrection. But in that resurrection, there really will be an affirmation of the created order, and with it a reaffirmation of the way of life built into creation itself, glimpsed by paganism at its best, but unattainable within that framework. There is, as I hinted much earlier, a parallel here with what Paul says about the Jewish law. The Jewish law looks on at God's achievement in Christ and by the Spirit and applauds it, even though the law itself, being weak because of the flesh, is unable to produce that result. Romans chapter 8 verses 3 and 4. In the same way, the work of grace will produce a kind of human life which the serious pagan ought to acknowledge as genuinely and fully human, and which the Christian ought to see, in retrospect as it were, as the goal toward which the paganism of Paul's day had been pointing, however impotently. Which brings us to another question. Is there a complete disjunction between the theory of virtue, as for instance in Aristotle or Seneca, and the theory we have seen developing in the proclamation of Jesus and the teaching of Paul? No. I suggest that, at the level of theory, we witness something very similar to what we have just seen at the level of practice. For Aristotle, we become virtuous by doing virtuous deeds. Second nature develops, and we grow into the full attainment of that which, glimpsing the goal of complete human flourishing, we have begun to practice. So for Paul, taking 1 Corinthians chapter 13 as the obvious example, here is the goal, the state of being teleos, complete. Here are the qualities of character which contribute to it. Here are the steps you must take to practice that quality of character. Or take Colossians chapter 3 or Ephesians chapter 4. Here is the state of perfect, mature humanness. Here are the qualities of character you must put on, clothing yourself with them, and learning how to practice them. It is only, I suggest, the somewhat frantic cult of spontaneity, and the more reflective but still insistent cult of authenticity, which has prevented readers of Paul over the last two centuries from recognizing what is going on. What Paul is arguing for is a Christian form of the ancient pagan theory of virtue. But it has indeed been thoroughly Christianized. It has itself, at this second level, been put to death and brought to new life. This is all about nature and grace again, but now in relation to the theories themselves, it isn't the case of Aristotle being topped up by Paul. Aristotle's tradition led ultimately to pride. Indeed, even some of his supporters have recognized a serious problem in his view that the fully virtuous person will have, as a kind of super virtue, a pride in his own achievement. For Paul, and this was one of the most painful things he had to work out, as we see in 2 Corinthians, the Christian life of virtue was shaped by the cross of Jesus Christ, resulting in a quite new virtue, never before imagined, humility. Just as the Christian practice of charity resulted in a way of being human that nobody had imagined before, caring voluntarily for people with no obvious claim on one's attention, so humility cut across not just all previous ideas of what virtue would look like, but across the ancient pagan theory of virtue itself, saying in effect that one of the highest virtues was the state where one was no longer conscious of one's own virtue. As C.S. Lewis said in another context, it is as though you met the sea serpent and discovered that it didn't believe in sea serpents. The Christianly virtuous person is not thinking about his or her own moral performance. He or she is thinking of Jesus Christ and of how best to love the person next door. These questions are not, though, simply a matter of detached theory. They are severely practical. They directly affect two other questions, both urgent. First, can we use ancient, non-Christian traditions to help us in our moral quest, or must we only use the scriptures? Second, can we address our non-Christian contemporaries on moral questions, or can we merely say to them, look at us, because we're Christians, we do it differently? If there is no major distinction, If we can read Aristotle and Paul side by side, shrug our shoulders, and learn from both with equal profit, and if we can contribute our 2 cents worth of wisdom to today's questions of public morality along with everyone else, then we have clearly taken a large step away from the world of the Gospels and the Epistles. On the other hand, if there is no overlap, no point of contact, then we are in a closed world. We are sealed off from learning anything new from the outside, but also, more worryingly, sealed off from being able to give anything. Why should the world take any notice of us? If I stand up in Parliament and say that because I live in a world shaped by the faith and life of the Christian Church, I don't believe in euthanasia, those in that place who don't share that faith will smile and say in effect, "Very well, but since we don't start from that Christian premise, we won't take any notice." Is there no continuity between Christian morality and that of the wider world? If we claim that Christian faith produces genuine humanness, must there not be many areas of massive overlap on which we can work toward agreement? A good deal of Christian theology down through the centuries has worried away at questions on this borderland, sometimes moving towards saying that the world is basically good but in need of some help and advice, and sometimes moving towards saying that the world is basically bad and in need of rescue and a complete makeover. It has proved difficult to say what many have wanted to say, that the world is a rich and strange mixture of good and bad, and that the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ both passes judgment on its utter and rebellious wickedness and reaffirms, the other side of that judgment, its inherent God-created goodness. But something like this, I believe, is necessary. I hope I have indicated one way, at least, in which we can do this in the sphere of moral discourse. There is much more that could be said at this level, but not here. I hope that among the effects of this book will be that I have alerted virtue theoreticians to the wealth and depth of material in the New Testament, which they have normally ignored by going straight for the major subsequent exponents such as Aristotle and Aquinas. And I hope, conversely, to have alerted New Testament ethicists to the fact that Jesus and his first followers can be understood within the context of ancient pagan theories of the moral life, not in terms either of straightforward borrowing or simplistic topping up, but in terms of a transformation of the theory itself. The early Christians believed that they were the true temple of God, filled with God's glorious presence by his Spirit, and called to reveal that glory to the world. They therefore saw themselves standing in a relation to all other temples, Jewish and pagan, as the reality stands to the parodies. Imagine suddenly meeting a public figure you had previously known only through grisly caricatures in popular newspapers. In the same way, the early Christians seem to have believed that their way of glimpsing the ultimate goal of human life, and their way of practicing it in the present time, was the reality for which the ancient pagan goal of happiness and the virtues which anticipated and cultivated it, or at best a fine parody. Whether we go on with Augustine to declare that pagan virtues are therefore ultimately merely splendid vices, leading people toward pride and so away from the God revealed in Jesus Christ, or whether we hold out the possibility that, by the pagans grasping at such possibilities of moral life as they knew, they were in fact responding already, as best they could, to God the Creator, is a further question beyond the scope of this book. There may be some to whom Jesus might say, as he did to the scribe, "You are not far from God's kingdom," Mark chapter 12, verse 34. Not far, of course, indicates that there is still a short but significant step to take. 5. I have suggested that part of the inner dynamic of virtue itself, seen from a Christian point of view, is precisely to point away from itself and outward to God in worship and to the world in mission. That is what it means to be a royal priesthood. I now want to show how Christian holiness is not a separate idea from worship and mission, but belongs organically and intimately within that picture. All this is contained in the idea of being remade in God's image. The point of a mirror isn't that it's useful or beautiful in itself, but that it reflects the face of the one who looks into it. The point of an angled mirror is that it reflects one thing to another, in this case, God to the world, mission, and the world back to God, worship. I now propose that the New Testament's vision of Christian virtue, of the holiness to which Jesus' followers are called and for which they are equipped by the Spirit, can be understood, and is perhaps best understood, as a function of that dual role. It isn't, in other words, that there are two separate things going on, first a call to holiness, and second a call to worship and mission, or even three separate things, if worship and mission are likewise separated, as sadly they often are. Rather, the call to holiness comes precisely because it is as genuine human beings that we will be able to sum up the praises of creation, and as genuine human beings that we will be able to bring God's justice, freedom, beauty, peace, and above all, rescuing love to the world. This, I take it, is the line of thought which Paul envisages when he insists that holiness must be aimed at mission. Do everything without grumbling and disputing. That way you will be blameless and pure, unblemished children of God in the middle of a twisted and depraved generation, among whom you shine like lights in the world, holding out the word of life. That's what I will boast of on the day of the Messiah, since it will prove that I didn't run a useless race or work to no purpose. Philippians chapter 2, verses 14 through 16. The world is dark. You are to shine God's light into it. Here Paul is drawing together various strands of Jewish expectation, of Israel's call to be the light to the world. Isaiah chapter 49, verse 6. God's call to his servant, who has just been anxious in verse 4, that he might have been working to no purpose. In particular, Paul is echoing Daniel chapter 12, verse 3, where the prophet declares, "Those who are wise will shine like lights in the sky, and those who turn many to righteousness, like the stars forever and ever." Interestingly, one of the ancient Greek translations of the phrase, "those who turn many to righteousness," decided on a paraphrase, rendering it, "those who are powerful in my word." Paul may be echoing that version in the text quoted above, where he speaks of holding out, or perhaps holding fast to, the word of life. The point is this. Those who follow the crucified and risen Jesus and hail him as Lord, chapter 2, verse 11, those who work out what their own salvation is going to mean, as opposed to the various forms of salvation offered by the pagan world around them, chapter 2, verse 12, those in whose lives the living God is now at work to accomplish his good pleasure, chapter 2, verse 13, these people are to be holy for the sake of the mission in which Israel's call to be the light of the world is at last realized. With this, the glory of God the Father, chapter 2, verse 11, which is displayed when people hail Jesus as Lord, is unveiled before the nations as Isaiah had promised, chapter 60, verses 1 through 3, no longer hidden in the temple. The holiness of Jesus' followers is part of the necessary equipment for them to be the royal priesthood. The early Christians clung to this vocation in the teeth of harsh evidence that the light would not be well received by the dark world. This is a major theme in the Gospel of John. Nevertheless, they were to continue with the project. Their holiness would be a sign to the world that there was indeed a different and better way to be human, even if the only effect would be that the world would be without excuse when God finally put everything to rights. Peter conveys the same message. Immediately after declaring that Jesus' followers are a royal priesthood, formed to proclaim the powerful deeds of the one who called them from darkness to light, he continues, "Beloved, I beg you to hold back from the fleshy lusts which are fighting a war against your real selves. You are, after all, aliens and exiles. Maintain good conduct among the pagans, so that when they sneer at you, as though you are evildoers, they may see your good behavior and give God the glory on the day when he visits in judgment." 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 11 and 12. The point is repeated in the following chapter. Always be ready to explain yourselves to anyone who asks you about the hope that is in you, but do it with gentleness and reverence, maintaining a good conscience, so that when you are spoken against, those who are reviling your good behavior in Christ may be put to shame. 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 15b to 16. The whole sequence of thought we're exploring is exactly that of Ephesians chapter 4 and 5. After the great opening of that section, chapter 4, verses 1 through 16, urging the church to work hard for unity and to see the varied ministries within it as contributing to the state of completeness, of maturity in Christ, Paul goes on to emphasize the necessity of a radical break with the pagan pattern of life. That is the setting in which Jesus' followers are to take off your former lifestyle, the old humanity. That way of life is decaying as a result of deceitful lusts. Instead, you must be renewed in the spirit of your mind, and you must put on the new humanity, which is being created the way God intended it, displaying justice and genuine holiness. Ephesians chapter 4, verses 22 through 24. The point of this, as of Philippians chapter 2, is that Paul's listeners are instead to live as light in the midst of darkness, as resurrection people in a world of death, Ephesians chapter 5, verses 8 through 14. To this end, they will need to deploy all the regular means by which Christian character can be fostered, avoiding the obvious causes of corruption such as sexual immorality and drunkenness, and embracing the life of forgiveness, kindness, and above all, grateful worship. Chapter 4, verse 25 through chapter 5, verse 20. The same point is likewise made in Romans. Those who are to be God's agents in the final putting to rights of all creation, those for whom creation itself has been longing, since only when they are revealed as true human beings will creation itself be renewed, are those who must learn to put to death the deeds of the body, chapter 8, verse 13, so that they may live. If they are to be the royal priesthood, ruling over God's new world, Romans chapter 5, verse 17, they must be people through whose lives shine a genuine humanness, reborn in Christ after judgment has been passed on their own sin. God's work of rescuing restorative justice must happen in us in order that it can happen through us. That is the inner logic which links personal conversion, faith, and sanctification with the wider task of the church in the world. From all this, and there is of course much more besides which we could have explored, it should be clear that the New Testament envisages the holiness of God's people as a major factor in their larger vocation to be the lights of the world. From this there emerge those particular features of Christian behavior, those particular virtues which nobody, except in some cases the Jewish people, had thought of as virtues before, and which, according to Jesus and the early Christians, were the secret clues to that genuine humanness through which the Creator God would be made known in his world and the world would be summoned to worship. I return to the earlier quoted list of these characteristics offered, almost as a throwaway line, by Simon Blackburn. Humility, charity, patience, and chastity. These are all on display again and again in the pages of the New Testament, and they contributed materially to the sheer puzzlement of ancient paganism when faced with the early Christians. Why would anyone want to behave like that? The Christian answer was, and is, that these virtues exemplify and model genuine humanness. That this genuine humanness was lived out by Jesus himself, whose life is given to his people by his Spirit. And that in Jesus, and indeed in all who share his way of being human, one can see the genuine reflection of the Creator God, so frequently parodied in paganism, but so clearly redisplayed in the death and resurrection of Jesus. This composite of virtues is what the proper man looked like. This is what his followers must look like. It is thus more or less impossible to speak of God with any conviction or effect if those who profess to follow Jesus are not exemplifying humility, charity, patience, and chastity. These are not optional extras for the especially keen, but the very clothes which the royal priesthood must put on day by day. If the vocation of the royal priesthood is to reflect God to the world and the world back to God, the world that is as it was made to be and as by God's grace it will be one day, that vocation must be sustained and can only be sustained by serious attention to putting on these virtues, not for the sake of a self-centered holiness or pride in one's own moral achievement, but for the sake of revealing to the world who its true God really is. The church has been divided between those who cultivate their own personal holiness, but do nothing about working for justice in the world, and those who are passionate for justice, but regard personal holiness as an unnecessary distraction from that task. This division has been solidified by the church's unfortunate habit of adopting from our surrounding culture the unhelpful packages of left-wing and right-wing prejudices, the former speaking of justice and meaning libertarianism, and the latter speaking of holiness and meaning dualism. All this must be firmly pushed to one side. What we need is integration. The high calling of Christian morality is therefore the necessary handmaid of the still higher callings of Christian worship and mission. The virtues which constitute the former are the vital components of the latter. The only way for worship and mission to become second nature to the followers of Jesus is for the virtues, the Spirit's fruit, the passion for unity, and the celebration of the multiply varied vocations within the one body, all to become second nature as well. Otherwise, worship will be a sham and mission a mere projection of ideologies. Reflecting God's image means learning the disciplines of a God-reflecting human life. 6. So what are those disciplines, and how can we learn them? This points us forward to the final chapter in this book, First, though, some preliminary words are in order about the way in which the earlier named strikingly different Christian virtues, humility, patience, chastity, and charity, have developed over time. Humility, in the Western world at least, has gradually come to be accorded a grudging respect. True, some philosophers, notably Nietzsche, have pooh-poohed it, dismissing it as a weak, spineless thing, the cause or sign of human degeneracy, rather than true nobility. Humility can easily be parodied on the one hand and pretended to on the other, and neither makes a pretty sight. False humility is as unattractive as over-the-top fawning. Only twice have I received regular messages from correspondents signing themselves "Your humble servant," and it was clear that actually neither of them had any intention of doing what I suggested. But our culture has shifted noticeably from the ancient world, where self-advertisement was the expected norm, where, for example, Cicero could congratulate Rome on its good fortune in coming to new birth while he was consul, and where Augustus could write a book about his achievements and have the whole thing carved in stone by the banks of the River Tiber for all to read to this day. We don't like it when people start off down that road these days, and we tend to pull them up sharply. Showing off has had a bad press, especially in England. As cultural critic George Steiner has commented, the phrase, "oh, come off it," is a particularly English expression, hard to translate into an exact and equally devastating equivalent in other languages. To that extent, something of the Christian virtue of humility has remained, at least in outline, within post-Christian Western culture. However, we have revived something of the ancient pagan alternative in our passion for the heroes and heroines of sport, popular music, and other similar attractions. We expect them to fulfill the role of celebrity in being both superhuman in some respects and more or less subhuman in others, in their undisciplined use of drugs, alcohol, fast cars, and sex. They reflect, in fact, an image which is well known to students of the classical world, the gods and goddesses of ancient Greece and Rome, who were powerful, dazzling, capricious, licentious, and unusually helpful to people they liked, and dangerous to people they didn't. And when, within a would-be Christian culture that has forgotten its roots, as ours has, preachers and teachers of the gospel are treated in the same way as other celebrities, their now routine fall from grace, usually through financial or sexual misdemeanor, is simply a sign that all along they were deeply out of tune with the core message. This applies equally to the televangelist who has embezzled millions in church funds and to the parish priest who has sexually abused children. They have enjoyed a status in their communities which has encouraged them to a kind of humanness that reflects not the generous and self-giving love of the Creator God, but the self-glorifying and self-gratifying lust of the pagan gods and goddesses. The same holds true for patience. Patience is one of the places where faith, hope, and love meet up. Those who believe in God the Creator and in the eventual triumph of His good purposes for the world will not be in a hurry to grasp at quick-fix solutions in their own life or in their vocation and mission, though they will not be slow to take God-given opportunities when those arise. In particular, they will not be in a hurry to force ideas and solutions on other people. Not for nothing is patience the first thing that Paul says about love, 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 4. Here again our culture is pulled two ways. We applaud patience, but prefer it to be a virtue that others possess. When a well-known bank, introducing credit cards to an unsuspecting public in the early 1970s, declared that their piece of plastic would take the waiting out of wanting, it struck two very different chords among its hearers. Some, the majority, decided that that's what they'd always wanted and signed up. Others, who appeared at the time to be living in the past and to be out of date, warned that this slap in the face to the virtue of patience would bring its own dire rewards. A generation later, with levels of personal debt in the Western world at unprecedented astronomical levels, not least among young people, the second group have improved right again and again. This is not to say that there is not a responsible use of credit cards and similar schemes. It is only to say that when a society as a whole decides that patience is outmoded, something about its genuine humanness takes a severe blow. And when humanness deteriorates, the results are corruption, in the sense of something decaying or going bad, and slavery. Patience is needed for the pursuit of all the virtues, of course. Part of that same have-it-all-now culture, as applied to Christian living, declares that now that you're a Christian, indwelt by the Spirit, you ought to be instantly holy. You want to be like Jesus Christ, pray this prayer, have this experience, and it's all yours. No, replies Patience, with humility standing close beside. We shall learn the present lesson this week, the next one the following week, and so on. We shall practice the virtues, step by step, putting them on with conscious thought and effort, even though the clothes don't seem to fit us very well at the moment. We won't be distracted, either by the glittering offers of instant fix-it spirituality or the sneering charges that we're just putting it on, just being hypocrites. And then there is chastity. It comes as a surprise to many people to discover just how much the ancient Christians and the ancient Jews were seen as out of step with the surrounding culture in this area. Just about everybody in the ancient world took it for granted that people had, to put it straightforwardly, as much sex as they could get. Marriage, between a man and a woman, was one thing, and many either wanted to stay faithful or were afraid, for whatever reason, to stray. The main problem with adultery, though, was not the moral lapse, but the jealous spouse. Unmarried sexual liaisons were common and expected, and in a world where abortions were often procured, and unwanted children abandoned to wild beasts, some of the residual problems were easily dealt with, leaving the main difficulty, that of the family trying to marry off a daughter with a past. Other taboos existed in various times and places. In ancient Athens, for example, there was a carefully graded scale of what was acceptable when a man was conducting homosexual friendships with younger men. But nobody thought that homosexual behavior, including lifelong quasi-marital partnerships, was particularly unusual, let alone reprehensible in and of itself. Indeed, Plato, in the Symposium, celebrated such partnerships as the highest form of love. Other quite different forms of sexual activity, such as sex with animals, was something at which most people shrugged their shoulders. A good deal of all this behavior took place in and around pagan temples, but it was by no means confined to them. The early Christians shared the view of Jews, ancient and modern, that this kind of behavior was dark and dehumanizing, distorting the very essence of what it means to be human. Sex was given, they believed, for the mutual and outward-looking delight of husband and wife, outward-looking because, like God's love, the love of spouses generates new creation, both in the procreation of children and in the creation of a warm, secure, and hospitable home. That, rather than arbitrary prejudice or fear-driven repression, is why they rejected the all-too-familiar way of their world. They believed themselves called to shine into this darkness the light of a different way of being human. The striking contrast of their belief and behavior with their milieu at this point goes back solidly to Jesus himself. Jesus warned, in a passage we looked at earlier, against the kind of unclean behavior which emerges unbidden from the deep recesses of the human personality. The terms in which he issues that warning, echoing and endorsing central prohibitions from the Old Testament, make it clear that, despite popular impressions to the contrary, he is firmly endorsing the ancient Jewish prohibition on sexual relationships of any sort outside the lifelong marriage of a man and a woman. The whole New Testament insists that the point of Christian living is the remaking of humans in God's image, and when we trace that idea to its root, it is clear that the image-bearing pair are male and female, called to leave others and cleave to one another. Not for nothing have theologians from that day on seen that human union as a sign of the unbreakable commitment of the Creator God to His creation. We should not be surprised that, when heaven and earth finally come together at the end of the book of Revelation, the image used is that of a marriage. That is the telos, the goal of all our existence. Virtue grasps that goal by faith and learns the lessons of living in the present in such a way as genuinely to anticipate that future, by fidelity within marriage and abstinence outside it. Western culture, comprised largely of at least nominally Christian nations, has been partly colonized by the Christian vision of marriage and sexuality, but mostly not. Attempts at enforced abstinence have come and gone, to be replaced, again intermittently, by virtually enforced indulgence. Think of the 17th century with the Restoration following the Puritans, or the rebellion after the First World War against supposed Victorian standards. Though history reveals that a good deal of 19th century Europe was just as sexually unrestrained as any other time. Street-level Freudianism, which assumes that sex is at the bottom of everything, unless you can't resist it so you shouldn't try, and street-level Darwinism, which insists that what matters is the life force that leads us to propagate ourselves, so we'd better get on with it, have together created a climate where, in the popular mind, any serious call for restraint, either in the mode or in the particular circumstances of sexual expression, is met, not with serious argument, but with scorn. exclaimed one correspondent to a popular paper the other day. All this talk of abstinence by some misguided right-wing lunatics. Pretty soon biology will kick in and then they'll be at it like everyone else. In other words, biology rules. We have urges we can't control, and it's unhealthy and unnatural to resist. Multiple sexual partnerships, and now even multiple quasi-contractual relationships, polyamory, with three or more people entering into multidirectional sex-sharing agreements, are making their way into accepted behavior. Easy contraception and abortion have opened the floodgates to a fresh round of sexual license over the last few decades, a license that even the AIDS crisis has done little to check. Yet Christians have always insisted that self-control is one of the ninefold varieties of the Spirit's fruit. Yes, it's difficult. Yes, you have to work at it and discover why certain temptations, at certain times and places, are hard to resist. That's because chastity is a virtue. It's not first and foremost a rule which you decide either to keep or to break, though certain rules are clear enough scripturally. It's certainly not something you can calculate according to a principle, such as the greatest happiness of the greatest number, not least because the overwhelming short-term happiness of most sexual congress would tip the scales artificially. And in particular, as Jesus himself indicated, it won't be generated by going with the flow of what comes naturally. This is where the genuine celibate, like Jesus himself, and like a great many unsung heroes and heroines both in monastic communities and in plenty of less obvious places, have discovered the joy of a second nature self-control, which much of our culture, like most of the ancient world, never even imagines. By contrast, as those of us who care pastorally, or in families, for people who have embraced the present habits of society will know, the bruises and wounds caused by those habits are deep, long-lasting, and life-decaying. The church is often called a killjoy for protesting against sexual license. But the real killing of joy comes with the grabbing of pleasure. As with credit card usage, the price tag is hidden at the start, but the physical and emotional debt incurred will take a long time to pay off. Here, patience and humility, standing on the sidelines, come into play once more. The frantic urge towards sexual intimacy is part of the drive to express yourself, to push yourself forward, to insist that this is who you are and this is how you intend to behave. No, says humility. You don't discover your true self that way. You find it by giving yourself away. Precisely, agrees patience. Taking the waiting out of the wanting is shortchanging yourself and everybody else. The virtues are linked together, just as Aristotle said regarding his list of four, courage, temperance, prudence, and justice. If you want one of them, you'd better develop all of them. And so, of course, to charity, which, as we noted, is described by Paul as the virtue which you need to put on over and around all the others, like the belt which keeps the rest in place, Colossians chapter 3, verse 14. Love, the normal, if imprecise, word we use because charity is shrunk, is the thing that will enable patience, humility, and chastity to stay in place, because love respects the other person and wants the best for him or her. And love in turn is sustained, as in Paul's famous passage, by faith on the one hand and hope on the other, altogether looking at God the Creator and Recreator and at his promises, made sure and certain in Jesus Christ. Western society has known something of this love. Forgiveness is held as a virtue by many in our world, in a way which is quite foreign to some other world views. I recall the shock on being told by a friend in the Middle East that forgiveness had never been seen as a good thing there. We know we don't do it, by and large, but we think we should. The result of this, unfortunately, is that we have developed a corollary that is neither love nor forgiveness, namely tolerance. The problem with this is clear. I can tolerate you without it costing me anything very much. I can shrug my shoulders, walk away, and leave you to do your own thing. That, admittedly, is preferable to my taking you by the throat and shaking you until you agree with me. But it is certainly not love. Love affirms the reality of the other person, the other culture, the other way of life. Love takes the trouble to get to know the other person or culture, finding out how he, she, or it ticks, what makes it special. And finally, love wants the best for that person or culture. It was love, not just an arrogant imposition of alien standards, that drove much of the world to oppose the apartheid regime in South Africa. It was love, not a dewy-eyed anti-business prejudice, though that's what they said to him at the time, that drove abolitionist William Wilberforce to protest against the slave trade. It is love, not cultural imperialism, that says it is dehumanizing and society-destroying to burn a surviving widow on her husband's funeral pyre, or to kill the daughter who has eloped with a man of a different religion or race.